every Thursday at 11 a.m., Coach Rick Byrd joins us in studio. He was in Knoxville for Tennessee and Vanderbilt. Coach, how are you?
I'm good. How are you guys?
Doing very well. Before we begin, congratulations on the court at Belmont. The ceremony that took place looked fantastic. I was out of town, unable to make it, but I watched the video that they tweeted out through the program. Congrats. I know that was very special for you, and it seemed like everything was very well done.
Well, very cool. Thanks. It was a big night, and Belmont really, really did a nice job, and had all of my family there, and gosh, 70-something former players there. And a bunch more that couldn't make it because they're either coaching right now or they're playing overseas and couldn't be there. So, but mostly, number one, it's so nice of Belmont to make that decision. But the way they put that together was really well done.
You have good handwriting, but I'm wondering, did they ask you to sign something specific to use for that? Did they lift it from somewhere? What do you know?
Yeah, they asked me to sign it. I don't.
How many times did you do it?
My wife would really disagree with you on the good handwriting comment.
How many times did you do it? Like, if I was asked to sign something that I knew was going to be in perpetuity like that, I think I'd probably need 100 tries until I got one.
And then Uncle Harsky would go all the way to midcourt.
That's right. Yeah. But how many times do you
start choking, to tell you the truth, when people are watching you and you're trying to do it like it really looks, but more legible than it normally would be, and there's somewhere in between. So I'm going to say 15 times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you were like, that's it. That's the one.
they said that. I didn't really care.
This is as good as it's going to get. had you seen it prior to unveiling the court?
I had seen it on a really small form of it because they – it was about them showing where everybody was going to go stand and be when the ceremony was going on.
How did they tell you that they were going to do this?
Dr. Fisher asked me to his office along with Scott Corley, and they told me, and it was emotional for me, but that doesn't surprise most people that know me. But it's just think about all the things that can happen when you go somewhere to coach. That doesn't happen very often, and so it was really meaningful.
What did you think they were going to meet with you about?
I didn't have any idea.
You're coming back.
Casey hadn't lost any games by that point, so I didn't think that. I thought maybe tennis or golf coach would be a good thing, but no.
Australian correspondent.
I really didn't think about that.
Ladies and gentlemen, your new president of Belmont University, Rick Byrd. You were at the Tennessee-Vandy game in Knoxville on Tuesday night. We spent some time talking about it yesterday. Ugly game from an offensive standpoint, and Rick Barnes was not happy at halftime and after the game. He was asked about his team's offense the first half, and he said pathetic. And he said they disrespect the game of basketball the way they treat offensive possessions at times. You were there in the arena. What was your big takeaway as you watched – both of those teams sort of muddle through that game before Tennessee finally took control?
Well, that's an emotional response for sure. When you get asked on the spot, you know, I've used a lot of similar words about how we are playing at halftime or just after the game. But the first, you know, the first 16 minutes, it looked like it was going to be two teams in the 40s. And both teams kind of picked it up in the last 3 or 4 minutes of the first half. And, I just think neither team has go-to guys. Neither team has anyone that you have to think about helping so much off of, onto, that it creates rotation on the defense. And about all that either of them can do is when they set a really good ball screen and make that post defender help further than they want to, and the guy rolls, and then they find the right guy. That takes a lot of things going right. I watch ball screen actions, and I see that it should have worked, but the guy with the ball doesn't make the right decision.
Do you see Vescovi for Tennessee developing more of a game that's suitable for Southeastern Conference play as he continues along?
I do. I think he's a bright spot. He's a little He's different. He's not that blow-by kind of point guard that can use ball screens well. But you can't really go under his ball screens because he shoots it good enough. That's one thing you can do with a lot of quick point guards is take a chance on whether they can make that shot consistently enough from behind it. You can't do that with him. And I think, by and large, his decisions coming off of that, I think he understands the right reads and very often makes the right one. I think he has to be getting used to the speed of the game at this level. I don't know what the play looked like where he was, but I can't imagine that it's not a quicker pace and longer, tougher defenders and all that. And I think Coach Barnes has plenty of legitimate excuses. You know, he's gone through three different point guards this year, all of them different, and this guy practices 3 days, and then they're supposed to look like a well-oiled machine.
Well, and it's the question I have with Vescovi is, you see a team in football that runs the triple option, and that's a nice changeup for a team where it's difficult to prepare for that. You said different in describing him, and we were talking about this yesterday before the show. He looks slow, mm-hmm. but yet he's effective. Mm-hmm. He's got a set left-handed shot. There's just a lot of things that's a changeup
yep.
for most teams he's going to face. Is that something that can benefit him as he goes along, as he understands the urgency he has to play with when he's handling the ball and he understands the speed and everything else? He clearly has a high basketball IQ.
He does.
Is that something that can benefit him when you're different from a lot of other people that you're playing?
I think that goes for individuals, and I think it goes for teams. I've said that a lot about our Belmont teams within the OVC. We are a different kind of team, and you can prepare for all the other teams in the OVC in pretty similar ways, and then you play a team that plays differently, four out, one in, a lot of ball movement, less ball screen, less driving. So I think a player is the same way, and I think he's got that. He's got a lot of intangibles about his game that I like.
That was a hard game to watch for those of us yep. who were late for laymen. What's it like for a coach or an ex-coach to watch a hard-to-watch game?
Pretty much the same, maybe worse at times. I think a low-scoring game is fine if it's because of really well-played defense. And you look at Tennessee's numbers, and they're good. They're a good defensive team. Rick Barnes's teams are going to be good defensively. And the fact that he's brought new people in and they're still putting up the same kind of defensive numbers. But, you know, and I could watch Virginia all year last year, and some people couldn't, and I get that. But they are so well coached and so good defensively that, you know, I can watch a 1-0 baseball game or hockey game when a lot of people don't like that either. If it's well played, I'm okay. But that was sloppy, really sloppy for the first 16, 17 minutes. They both did better coming out of the halftime.
Can a team, and all due respect to Vanderbilt, and we've talked about, they just don't have the players right now for Jerry Stackhouse, and that's why they have one win in the SEC in the last 2 years. Can a team like that, in your coaching experience, cause your team to play sloppy at times also because the way they junk things up?
Well, it's not only that. It's the fact that when you look at Tennessee's schedule, who they've played and who they're going to play, Vanderbilt was the one game coming in that they
probably took for granted.
Subconsciously, the players are not going to be as geared up for as they're going to be for other big games because they can look at it and think that's human nature. Coaches talk about it differently all the time. In fact, you could turn the tables on your team and say this is the most important game of the rest of them. If we can't get this one, if we can't play hard right now, then we ought to mail it in. But I do think it happens. It happens a lot. And it's also the most frustrating kind of game to coach. A team you know you're better than, and you're letting them hang around, and you're throwing the ball over the lot, and you can tell your team doesn't care enough.
Can you quickly tell, and not necessarily effort, physical effort at times, but urgency with a team that's lacking, even when you're watching and you're not coaching them? Because I've watched Tennessee all season, and I could tell until about 12 minutes left in the game when they fell behind by 5 points, yeah. and they showed some urgency on every offensive and defensive possession, it really wasn't there for most of the night. Can you see that?
I think probably, at least in my case, I'd give my team the benefit of the doubt for the first till the first time out. If we started slow, you don't want to jump on them. You don't want to. I mean, it's a long game. That's one of the things coaches say. Hey, this is, we got 36 more minutes to go. But you can tell pretty soon after that that how it's going to be. And sometimes you can't get it turned around. Again, going back to Belmont, they're paying for a SIU Edwardsville loss at home to a not a very good team because they tried to get their urgency back in the last 7 or 8 minutes, and the other team was too hot and too excited, and they couldn't get it done. And that happens, and that's what you try to tell your team. It can happen. You just can't decide you're going to start playing like this in the last 6-7 minutes of the game.
When we come back, I want to ask Rick Byrd about John Beilein and the attempt to go from college to pro, the failure there for it to succeed, and maybe if he has any insight from one of his former players who's on that roster in Cleveland.
Rick Byrd with us, presented by Beeman Automotive on 104.5 The Zone.
Rick Byrd on the Midday 180, presented by Beeman Toyota, home of the lifetime warranty. BeemanToyota.com 24/7.
It's the Midday 180 on 104.5 The Zone. Rick Byrd in studio with us. College basketball discussion this hour.
So John Beilein left Michigan to take the NBA test, and it didn't work out well for him out at the All-Star break. After finding that the NBA was maybe not as much about pure basketball as he had hoped. You're friends with him and had Dylan Windler there. What can you tell us kind of about what you know about the experience there and maybe what an awakening it is?
I'm disappointed for him. I do think he's one of the really good guys. He's maybe had a slip up here every now and then that might make people think differently, but that's not the case. He's a good man. He's a great basketball coach. He'll be remembered as that no matter what happens, whether he coaches again or not. But his style just isn't a fit for the NBA. And I had lunch with Dylan Friday, and we talked a little bit about it. And I went to the first game in Orlando because I thought Dylan was going to play, and I went anyway when I found out he wasn't. Watched their shoot around. John and I sat down afterwards, and I could tell he was already frustrated because he's used to a shoot around where the kids are focused and moving with purpose and talking and are into it. And he all of a sudden is coaching a bunch of guys that have to do that 80 plus times a year. Most of them have already done it. For years, Kevin Love, the kind of guys he had, and they just weren't into it. And we've all heard all the talk about he stresses fundamentals. One of the things that's made him a great coach. Those guys play like they want to play.
How does a style like Brad Stevens work and Beilein not work?
That's a great question.
It is good to compare those two and wonder what the difference is, because you would certainly say by looking at two of them that they're similar in a lot of ways, the way they approach the game. And my guess is that Brad was much younger and knew he was in this for the long haul. And if you remember, they had a merry-go-round of guys getting on and off his first year in Boston. And I think he dealt with the losing and used it as a learning time. And so I just think he decided this. I'm gonna have to learn how to coach the best I can, but I've got more time to do it. John hadn't lost much, and he's 67 years old, and I can just see the frustration building so much faster for him. But my guess is Brad was just committed to learning how to coach NBA players more than John was.
Maybe I don't give enough credit to the coaching in the NBA, but I've said before, Coach, I feel like in the NBA there are only a handful of coaches that truly have the grasp and the leadership of their team and their roster, and even then, those guys even have legitimate superstar qualities on their roster that are really running the locker room. It is such a different dynamic, just one level up from college play.
It sure seems like it, without a doubt, as we just talked about a little bit off air. The minutes sometimes are decided by the GM or the ownership more than the head coach. I'm sure when you get to where Popovich is, maybe that's not the case. It'd be very tough to coach that way. It wouldn't be tough to see your paycheck, I don't think, but it would be.
Is the money considerably better?
I think it is.
So it's not like college football.
I mean, I think I saw where Bickerstaff, as associate head coach, is making $1.6 million. This year. And I think it's very, very significant. And I do know Brad good enough to know that Brad's doing it because he loves to coach. And I'm sure he's glad to make the money, but and John Beilein is a coach's coach, and he loves to coach basketball, and I doubt he did that. In fact, he just gave away a whole lot of money by what he did, and it almost proves it wasn't about that.
It proves that he was just fed up with the atmosphere.
Do you think it's a – and I look at that, and you were talking about the comparison between Brad Stevens and Beilein. Is it a generational thing? Is it a gap in how you control a team and command a team with coaches? In other words, the new guard in college basketball of younger coaches, would they have an easier transition to the NBA, or is it you need to come up through the NBA ranks as an assistant to really fully grasp what the job is as an NBA head coach, and anyone that coaches in college is going to have a hard time with that adjustment?
Well, I think you've hit on something in terms of the generational difference, without question. I think probably if a college coach could, and we've seen a bunch of them, Tim Floyd, I mean, you guys name a bunch of them. You follow it more than I do, probably.
Lon Kruger was one that's gone up and down.
Well.
Patino.
Calipari and Patino. I mean, there's – anyway, Hoiberg, not a lot of great success going from college to the pros. But I think it's almost more of a – Brad Stevens is a really smart guy, and I think he just decided I'm going to learn how
Larry Brown
the best way to coach these guys and get the most out of them, even though I got to do it way differently than I did Gordon Hayward when he was at Butler.
Rick Bird in studio with us. Everybody has an opinion, Coach, on Penny Hardaway. What's yours on the job that he's doing in Memphis right now?
Oh, gosh. I have not watched Memphis play except for snippets here and there. I know he's lost, for different reasons, two of his best three players. But one of them, you could say, is not really bad luck. It's, okay, we recruited a guy this way, and this is what happened, and he decided he wasn't going to sit out his nine games or whatever the penalty was. And of course, the other kid gets injured. I tell you what shocked me when I was looking through the scores one night and saw 80-40 against Tulsa, and I coached a lot of games, and got beat 40 by teams that were way better than us, but not against a team that's good, but maybe you're supposed to be better, and so that just told me he's lost his team a little bit here, and it looks like he has, and it's just. You guys know we've talked about it a long time. How good are great basketball players at coming in and coaching? Because they didn't have to listen and learn a lot while they played.
Right. He's impacted that area quite a bit. Chad and I called some of his high school games at the state tournament, and you know what he did, not just for his team, but the middle school age kids with basketball shoes and the Nike commitments and everything that he brought in there.
Yep.
Been tremendous. I like some of the, some would say cocky, others say confident, but he came into that area back home and said, hey, this is Memphis basketball. We're ready for that smoke. Bring it.
Right.
And many people thought it was about competition. It's more than competition when you go into that level and you're recruiting on that high of a level, because now he has to deal with injuries and roster turnover and everything else that is involved with it. And that's led them down to in year two being what they are this year. And now people are actually asking the question, Chad, is he the long-term guy there? Or is he going to, is he the next guy that's like on the career path back to the NBA? That's an interesting one to follow because he had the number one recruiting class in the country whenever he had that press conference and said, we're ready for that smoke. And then as of right now, I'm not sure if they have a commitment for this class coming up, which is interesting to follow.
Well, and it's always unique to me when you have someone who's that powerful in one place. It's going to take a heck of a lot for fans of that school and people in that city to be out on Penny Hardaway.
You're right.
The grace
energy
period is going to be so. I mean, they're going to defend everything he does and everything he says.
Tickets sold through the roof. You're right.
And I think of Scott Frost in Nebraska. I
mean, right.
What would Scott Frost have to do to get fired from Nebraska? It's not even going to be a wins and losses thing. So
no, I don't think he's fired. But
you know how we look at Penny Hardaway because we're not attached to the city of Memphis is going to be different than the people there look at it, right? Right. Which is good for Penny Hardaway and his job security.
It is, but when you go in there promising the things he does, people are going to remember, and
yeah,
and it will slide away at some point if you don't deliver. It's scary to go in there and say the kind of things he said. You don't see any great coaches saying those things. And I know he wanted to build excitement and enthusiasm, but you don't see any great coach. You may say, hey, we've got a lot of talent, we have high mm-hmm. expectations, or whatever you want to say. But you don't say we can win a national championship this year, and it really pay off unless you do.
So Todd Parker is a huge Vanderbilt fan who listens to the show and tweets us. He's got a question for Coach Bird. He says, as a Vanderbilt fan, Coach Bird's name was always thrown out there whenever they had an opening. Could you guys ask him if he was ever approached officially or unofficially about the Vanderbilt job? We will ask Coach Bird that question and more when we come back.
Rick Bird with us on the Midday 180. Coming up at noon, your chance to win a pair of tickets to see the Deftones on August 30th at Nashville's Municipal Auditorium. Tickets are on sale now through Live Nation. Rick Bird in studio with us.
So one of our listeners, that's a big Vanderbilt fan, asked the question because yours was a name that would come up with the local ties anytime Vanderbilt had an opening. And I guess with Kevin Stallings there for so long, they didn't have an opening for years and years. But were you ever approached about that job from anyone?
Yeah, that's pretty much the answer. When Kevin got here, we were had just begun our Division I journey. And certainly I didn't have any kind of resume at that point to expect anybody to call good NAIA teams, you know, and a few bad Division I teams, and he was there for a long time and did a good job, and then but the answer is no, certainly in any kind of an official way. I, you know, when people would ask me at that point if I was interested, whether they had whether they could relay something back to anybody, I don't know. I would just say no. Not at this point.
You interviewed for the Tennessee job when they hired Konzo Martin. We've talked about that. Were there just a select few jobs that meant something to you that you would have even considered while at Belmont? Because yours was a name that did towards the end, especially every opening that would come up. If you had a hot board of 10 coaches, your name might be on there. Was it always it had to be the perfect fit and perfect place in your career, or was it not something you were that interested in at all?
Well, once again, by the time that I would appear on any of that my name would be legitimately considered, I was past mid-50s. I was 57, 58 years old. I loved Belmont. I loved the kind of young men that I got to recruit and played for us. And so when the Tennessee thing came along, and I got the call from Mike Hamilton that they were going to go in a different direction. It sounds easy to say now, but I was probably more glad than I was disappointed. You're always disappointed that you didn't get chosen, but it would have been a very tough decision for me, and it probably wouldn't have been for the right reasons. It probably would have been, hey, I can coach there 3 or 4 years, and I don't have to coach again with the money they pay at that level. Although Tennessee needed somebody to turn things around from the way it was left when Bruce Pearl left.
if you don't mind, I'm curious because we'll never be in a situation like this. How detailed of an interview process was that? Where not just a broad scope, but how detailed were you going into the room about your overall plan?
You know, I didn't worry too much about that. I felt like I knew enough about Tennessee basketball. I felt like that that my record spoke for itself.
No doubt.
And a lot of people get super prepared for those things. I guess it's a part of what I just said. If they wanted me and offered me the job, then I make a decision. But this is who I am. This is how I'm going to go about it. There were four people in the room, I think. My guess is the
Do you meet offsite? You don't meet in Knoxville for that, I'm guessing.
Atlanta. I think if I had to guess, it's can we take a guy that's built the program at Belmont and it looks like this because Belmont University looks like this, and can he jump in the middle of the AAU recruiting wars and all the junk that goes on there and get the kind of players that we've got to have to win games? Okay, maybe he coaches it good enough, but can he move from this kind to that? And I think even my assistants, when I would talk to other guys, to other schools about my assistant coaches and help them get the jobs, that I could feel that same kind of vibe going on there. It's just, you know, he did it at Vanderbilt. I mean, at Belmont. Say James Strong, for example. He played at Vanderbilt, and he coached at Furman and at Belmont. Can he go to some state school somewhere and have the same kind of program? So that's my best guess.
What's the magic answer there? Not the magic answer, but what do you think they want to hear? What's the convincing tone and the way to go about answering that question?
Well, the way I would have answered is there's not anything about my career that you can look at that says I can't get it done. If a guy's good enough, he can get it done wherever he's been or wherever he's going. Because it's more about that. It's more about the person. Are they a leader? Are they a winner? Are they a hard worker? They relate to kids. Do they get the game? Than it is about any of that other kind of stuff. Fit is great and important, and it was perfect for me at Belmont.
Is interviewing for Tennessee, you mentioned, because of your history growing up there, what your dad did for a living, your familiarity with the program, is that maybe the one job that you wouldn't have to research at all to go interview for? If you're, for instance, if North Carolina calls you, are you preparing a lot more for that interview as opposed to Tennessee just because you know Knoxville and you know that program?
Well, that's part of it. But at the same time, because I was so happy where I was, maybe I didn't. If I really wanted the job somewhere, I would research hard. But if, I mean,
you felt like it's something you just needed to do at that point.
I hate to sound cocky at all, but if you want me, here's what I've done, and I don't have to look back and see all this different stuff about your school. So that's the way I would have approached it at that point. Not maybe when I was 37 or 38 years old and really wanted a Division I job.
Looking at the OVC standings right now, Austin Peay and Murray State both 12-2 in conference. You've got Belmont right there at 11-3. For those three teams, and even an Eastern Kentucky at 10-4, or TSU at 8-6 behind them, what do you make of that race right now in the OVC? And just in general, when you're coaching a team that's in a quote unquote one bid league, and you're looking at getting ready for the conference tournament, where that's where everything matters in terms of the NCAA tournament, how are you approaching this final couple of weeks leading into that tournament?
Yeah, it's interesting. I had a call from a young coach last night in another league somewhere that asked me kind of the same question. How did I treat these last couple of weeks? How did you treat going into a tournament? What did you say to your team? And my answer was easy. I didn't change anything about the way that we coached the next game. We got ready for the next team and coached the next game. We didn't talk about. The players know how important the games are. They know that the tournament is everything. You can almost add to the pressure if you try to start doing things differently, try to motivate them. They don't need to be motivated, shouldn't need to be motivated. So that's my answer about the whole rest of it. We tried to win the first game we played. We tried to win the 11th. We did everything the same way every day of the game. So I think that's the best, most solid approach to it. I think, you know, in the case of this race, I think Belmont has a great chance to win their last four games. It's a matter of can they get in one of the top two spots where they get the double bye, and something's going to have to happen along the way helps them get there.
Chad, you mentioned North Carolina a few minutes ago, and that made me think of Roy Williams and some of the recent post games that we've seen him at the podium. I want to ask Coach Bird about that when we come back, and just the frustration, but he's also putting it on himself quite a bit, and it's just strange to look up and see the record next to North Carolina's program right now. That's coming up with Coach Rick Bird here on the Midday 180 on 104.5 The Zone.
Win $1,000 four times a day. The $1,000 Workday Payday. Listen for the keyword weekdays at 8:15, 11:15, 2:15, and 4:15 on 104.5 The Zone.
Coming up at noon today, your chance to win a pair of tickets to see Deftones Sunday, August 30th at Municipal Auditorium. That's Kuharsky for Paul Kuharsky.
Is it?
It is.
Really?
There's a few songs that I would definitely love to see live.
Like Spit?
Yeah. It could be, yeah. I think it's probably too harsh for you.
I'm not familiar.
Coach Rick Bird in studio with us. Last concert you went to, Coach, what would it be?
Oh, gosh. I went to see Matt Carney.
Oh, yeah.
In Chattanooga last week.
He puts on a great show.
Yeah, I like Matt Carney.
His mom was the woman who, this is going to sound funny, I got to say it the right way, married my daughter and her husband, and she was the officiant.
Okay.
Efficient,
okay.
Yeah, so, and then Matt's dad, Mike Carney, is a good friend. Came to all of our games. Played a lot of golf together, and so we went down and watched Matt, and he is very entertaining. A really, really good singer. I don't know what genre he is. He's a singer songwriter, but it's just good music.
It is. Basically. It is. It's not rock and roll, but it's right there on the edge of it, right?
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Look. But everything's considered rock and roll now in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So, yeah, I guess you could say rock and roll. Matt Carney. Coach is right. It's a great show if you have the chance to go see him. I was lucky enough to see him at the Ryman.
Yeah.
And anything's great in that building.
Sure.
He was phenomenal.
Yeah.
And a great singer-songwriter. You're right. Roy Williams. It sounds bad for me to admit this. I'm entertained by his post-game press conferences this season because of how honest he comes across, not just in what he's saying, but you can see it on his face. There was like a week ago where he admits to the media, and he dropped an F-bomb on accident and then immediately apologized. But he said, look, I'm not doing enough for my team. And then he goes on to say, I told so-and-so that, I'd fire me if I were him. And then he sat there for like 2 seconds, realizing what he had just said. And you could tell it hit him that he felt like he wasn't doing enough,
sure.
Which is odd to see a coach at that level come across in an honest moment. Not saying he's not like that behind the scenes at all, but at North Carolina with the success that they've had, this is clearly just an odd year when you see their record. A bizarre year, to be sure. But when you see Roy Williams saying these things, what comes to mind for you? What are you thinking?
Well, I think that's his strength as a coach. I think his kids see his passion for the game and how important it is to play the game as hard as they can play it. And he's a good basketball coach, but I don't think you put him down there at Virginia's defense or somebody else's offensive things. He plays Carolina basketball. You know what they're going to do. They go to the boards like crazy. They run the floor hard.
They get great players.
Yes, all that stuff. And whatever it takes to put yourself in a position to win a national championship, he's obviously done it 2 times down there. But I think he's real, and I've felt every bit of that stuff that he's saying. I mean, I don't know how many times I've said I should get, if we're gonna play like this, I should just get fired. They need to get a new coach. This is just, this is awful. And I love that he's putting a lot of it on himself. And I think that's the right thing to do. You can say whatever you want to say inside the locker room, but I think, you know, he kind of threw his team under the bus early in the year one time.
Yeah.
And since then, I think he's been careful to take a little bit more of the blame. But it's unbelievable to see North Carolina at the bottom of a 16-team league or whatever
they're
they
are. They're 3-12 right now.
In a league that's not very good this year, that maybe has three or four tournament teams in it in the entire conference.
Yeah, it's and I can't imagine – well, I can. I can't imagine how – frustrated he feels, how terrible he feels about where this team is this year, because he's never had that as a head coach. He's never had this kind of year, even close to it. It's got to be driving him crazy.
I know you were really impressed with Gonzaga when you watched them play. This seems like a year, because the North Carolina situation is one of them, but there's no truly great teams in those Power Five conference. There's some really good teams, but no truly great team that you're saying they're the favorite to win it all. Is this the year for a San Diego State, for a Dayton? Gonzaga's not a mid-major anymore. They're a major power. But is this the year for one of those teams to sneak up and win a national championship?
The whole thing.
And how much do you root for teams like that, being a longtime Belmont coach?
You know, I don't know that I root for anybody generally just because they're a good mid-major. I root a lot more for the guys that I admire, the way they run their program, kind of regardless of the rest of it. But I would sure like to see something great like that happen for Mark Few, as long as they have had great teams, the way he's built that program, and then the criticism that you naturally get when you become a top 10 kind of program, but you don't perform well in the tournament until a couple of years ago when they made a Final Four. So I'd love to see that happen for him, and it does seem the kind of year that maybe that could happen. I just cannot imagine. Brad Stevens could tell us, but I cannot imagine how you go through and you get wins against, and that your team's going to really believe when it gets to Final Four that it can win the national championship and that they really belong. We've seen teams get there and then literally lose by 30 points sometimes as a Cinderella team in a Final Four.
A couple of Cinderellas are ranked pretty high this year in San Diego State. Now Dayton.
Right.
And Dayton overcame a hurdle on the road at VCU right after making it to the top five. They were then faced with that road trip, right, and they win by 4 or 5 points. How much have you seen of Dayton this year, and how legit are they to be ranked where they are?
I saw them early out in Hawaii, and they were very impressive, and I've seen bits and pieces since then. And I mean, there's nothing I can say that doesn't put them there. They seem to be consistently good. And I don't care what league you're in, if you can just go on the road and win those games and win those games and win those games, you're good. You're just good. And so whether they're really a top five team when it's all said and done, I don't know. But they can beat all those other people that would be mentioned as top five teams.
Yeah. It's going to be an intriguing postseason.
It is. It's really going to be good.
Coach Rick Byrd, presented by Beeman Automotive. He joins us weekly at 11 a.m. on Thursdays. Always great to have you in studio. We appreciate it.
Thanks. Glad I made it this time, actually.
Take care of that.
Even with all that snow coming down out there right now, I got in.
What's the prognosis now?
On the knee?
Yeah.
It's not as bad as I thought it was a week ago, so I'm hoping I can still qualify for Wimbledon.
We'll be praying for your meniscus on the show.
That's right.
Thanks.